Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On Commons People this week.
On the plus side, John, we are all talking about the Labour Party.
Another successful day for the Labour Party.
Philip, did you fancy her instantly?
Absolutely.
Steady on, mate. She is the Prime Minister.
Took me out in overalls and a funny orange hat and some sort of slightly weird goggles.
What the hell is Tim Farron talking about? All of this and more on Commons People. Hello and welcome to Commons People, the HuffPost politics podcast with me, Owen Bennett, Paul Waugh, Kate Forrester, and this week, Aubrey Allegretti. How are you? Did I pronounce your surname correct?
You did indeed.
That's a good start, isn't it?
You're learning Italian, aren't you?
I'm trying my best, but I'm not specifically learning your surname. Thanks very much. This week, let's just kick off straight away with Labour's manifesto. It's out there and nobody was expecting it. Least of all, Andrew Gwynn, who is in charge of Labour's election campaign. Here he is on the Today programme this morning.
Well, it's not ideal, but on the plus side...
Not ideal?
On the plus side, John, we are all talking about the Labour Party this morning. We're all talking about some of the visions of how this country can be better, you know.
And then next week you've got to launch your manifesto. Well, it's already been launched. Are you still going to have a manifesto launch?
We absolutely are, because of course this is a draft version.
So Andrew Gwynn there wasn't expecting to be talking about his manifesto today. Let's talk about the politics here. First of all, how did this manifesto get out there into several newspapers? The Telegraph, The Mirror, and also Schools Week had the scoop, apparently.
Yeah, apparently Schools Week, but they're getting very upset they didn't get any credit last night.
Well, I'm getting upset that we didn't get the credit for the fact that we broke the story that they had its own housing department.
Don't worry, Owen, that was in the war zone this morning. No, what's really intriguing is obviously a lot of people, more than 80 people, have access to bits of the draft manifesto because it's approved today by a very big meeting in London. But very few have access to the whole thing. And individual shadow cabinet ministers even only have access to their bit of the manifesto. Now, that prompts the thought, who's leaked it? There's some suspicion that it could be trade unions because they get to see quite a lot of it. Other suspicion is actually that it could be someone in the leader's office and it's a great big double bluff and they're blaming Labour HQ for this leak when actually it's quite useful for them to get all these big policies out early. There's a bit of sort of, you know, criminology going on, but the fact is, it is out there.
But the thing with this leak is whenever something gets leaked, you always look at who benefits from the leak. And it seems to me that if you've got a meeting today, if you're you know, a Corbynite and you put together this manifesto and you've got a meeting today where you're worried that people could take some of the more left-wing things out, if you get it out there in advance, then it's already in the public domain, so you might as well just leave it in. So, and I was hearing that there's people in Corbyn's office who were suggesting that any other stories they put out yesterday for today were going to get blown out of the water by something else that's going to happen. So it seems to be suggesting that the leader's office did know about this.
I mean, there's a suggestion as well that HQ actually didn't have the full draft. It was only sort of a partial version that they had anyway.
That would make sense, because they don't trust HQ.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's this deep unease about whether or not people are undermining Jeremy Corbyn and allies of Ian McNichol, the party general secretary, whether or not, you know, they would actually leak it. So it doesn't make sense that somehow they are behind this, because they might not have had the full thing.
So with the manifesto obviously dominating the airwaves today, it was a perfect opportunity, wasn't it, Brie, for Jeremy Corbyn at his poster launch to stand up and give a really good speech endorsing it. And that's what he did, right?
No, unfortunately not. A couple of hours before, surprisingly, a spokeswoman said that he was going to pull out, and instead it was going to be Andrew Gwynn and Ian Lavery who were going to be there instead, leaving them to answer some sort of slightly awkward questions. They pulled off. It was a sort of sharp event. But yeah, Corbyn was nowhere to be seen. And I think it was Ian Lavery, who said that, yeah, Corbyn was busy dealing with internal party matters. Really,
it was a hell of a poster as well, though, wasn't it? I mean, Kate, you did the poster story last night, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
What is in the poster, for those who haven't seen it?
Okay, so...
paint this a picture with your words.
it's for the many, not the few.
Really?
Twice.
Right.
So there's that. There's also...
is it indescribable?
How do you phrase it?
I would phrase it as basic. Do you think that's fair?
It's, okay, but it's a picture
of the United Kingdom
being held back by what looks suspiciously like Theresa May's arm.
Yeah.
With a blue bracelet on.
When you say held back, doesn't it sort of, it looked as though it was implying that it was being dragged towards Europe to me.
Yes, that is a very good point. And I think actually there's the other reason that Corbyn was late. I understand, or not there, I should say. And I don't know why he didn't publicise this. Apparently he's got this tradition of walking to the town hall every general election to deliver in person his nomination papers. And apparently that is what he's been doing this morning. He's the last Labour candidate in London not to be a candidate because he hasn't actually submitted his papers. He's got this little tradition where he walks and does it himself. But anyway, well, maybe that is the real reason.
I mean, the launch was at 9 o'clock and this meeting's supposed to be happening at about noon, isn't it?
Exactly, but it's a long walk, maybe.
Let's talk about the content of the manifesto then. A lot of the front pages screamed today back to the 1970s. And some of the things that were in the manifesto, there was bringing about rail privatisation when the franchises expire. There was bringing back the mail into public ownership. There's a talk they're going to take back into ownership the electricity companies, but it wasn't quite that. They were going to set up some publicly owned electricity companies in the regions. There was abolishing tuition fees. I've looked at all of these, and the earliest one this is 1990, electricity privatised. It's not taking us back to the 70s, it's taking us back to 1989 when the first Stone Roses album came out. For me, that's a great time to go back to.
Interestingly...
Just for the music.
Yeah,
that's true. Interestingly, that is also in the Greens Environment Manifesto, which they are launching today.
Don't ruin it. We'll talk about that in depth later. No, we're not, obviously. sorry, Greens.
The publicly owned energy companies?
Yeah.
That's one of their policies.
They want to set up sort of community-run energy...
I think that's what's interesting. It speaks to a wider truth about this whole manifesto and how radical it is, which is, you know, in many ways, the people on the left really want full-blooded renationalisation. Why can't you renationalise all these industries? Why can't you have a proper renationalisation of the rail industry, for example? But you're not. You're getting piecemeal. In other words, when a franchise runs out, then a publicly owned company will be allowed to bid for it
or
take it over.
Automatically take it over, they can bid for
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. Right, okay. Or in some cases, when it comes to the energy firms, they will be taking it over. But the fact is, in energy, for example, it's a really difficult market. You know, you've got to buy and sell energy, you've got to trade in it. It's not for some sort of inexperienced company to do, even if it's a public sector one. And there are co-ops, small co-ops, that do things, but this is on a much bigger scale.
But I can see why people are saying go back to the 70s, right? Because the basic theme of this manifesto is very much public good, private bad. It's very much the market has failed. The only way we're going to get things like greater house building, fairness in different sectors, is if the government, the public, step in. But the point you made, which I think is the one that never really gets answered, is what makes you think that a bureaucrat in Whitehall or a town hall up north or whatever is going to have any greater expertise than the people who work for these companies? So, in a way, I guess it is going back to the 70s, isn't it? What do you reckon, Bree?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I think there was some briefing against, you know, the manifesto by those on the sort of right to moderate wing of the party. They clearly see it as, you know, something that's going to perform very, very badly for them electorally, and suggestion that, you know, Labour will lose as many seats as it did in 83 and 79. So, yeah, there's certainly that fear.
I think there is, though. Don't forget, a lot of polls show that nationalisation is popular. So rail nationalisation in particular. I mean, a lot of, you know, even Tory voters quite like the idea. I'm sick of these, you know, delays, etc. Why don't we have some proper control? Take back control! Why don't you use that phrase? And that's just what surprises me. Why doesn't Labour use that take back control message in its manifesto? You could do that on localism. You could do it on renationalising.
They can't take back control of their own comms.
Their own manifesto.
So cruel. That is a really good point. But I think that you said that policy is popular, rail privatisation. But if you look through all these policies, would you like free Twitter feeds? Would you like something free? Yes, I would. You know, people are going to individually like these policies, but you put it all together, And the only way they're going to raise the money is by raising corporation tax, which they say is historically low for developed countries, yeah. which is not for a
the
start.
The problem is that the IFS said this week that actually, you know, if you jack up corporation tax by that much, it ultimately you might not get as much money as you want because, you know, it hits the economy and jobs in the long term. And that will be difficult. That's why, I mean, I've put this morning in the email. I don't like to repeat what's in the email, but what was in the email was this line that someone
takes place now, listeners.
Someone said that this manifesto, the Corbyn's manifesto, is Miliband without the balls. Now that can be read in lots of ways, which is, you know, balls was the sort of seen as the sort of red Tory, you know, the guy who was not actually going to give the workers what they wanted and pay caps and public sector, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Austerity Light. So that's one version of it. But the other is that actually Balls was fiscally credible and, you know, a lot of people in the sort of centre of the party think that that's what's the big hole in this manifesto. It's not credible economically.
I mean, if we're looking at the manifesto, if the leak did come from Leader's office, we've got to look at it again as we have to look at the entire election campaign as a kind of quasi-leadership campaign. You know, what's going to come after the election when the probably inevitable happens. All of this, everything in it plays exactly to Corbyn's sort of core base. And, you know, getting all of these policies out there, people, his core support are going to rally around him and say, if we lose the man, we lose these policies, we lose all these fantastic policies, and this is what the Labour Party should be about.
And of course, similar to 83, in 83 when the manifesto was put forward on the Clause 5 kind of thing, Labour Party signed everything through without even looking at it, because the theory was, if we're going to lose, let's lose on Tony Benn's terms. Yeah. And I guess this way, for good or ill, in the same way that Andy Burnham said after he won the mayoralty last week, this is Jeremy Corbyn's moment, well, this is the left's moment now, isn't it?
They want him to own the manifesto so he can own the defeat. Yeah. That's the point. Well, let's see.
And they'll all be agreed on that. That's something which everybody in the party can agree on, not that this is Jeremy Corbyn's. We talked a bit about when things are privatised, and that's this week's quiz. No funny name.
Oh, like it.
We're recording it slightly early this week, so there's no...
Anyway, oh, no excuses.
So I couldn't think of anything. I'm tired. It's busy. right, okay. Isn't it, Brie?
Get on with it.
Sorry, right. When was British Airways privatised?
These are all going to be before I was born.
Yeah,
right?
that's a fair point.
Are you trying to imply before you were born as well?
No. I'm just helping Bree.
That's quite a good... Okay.
But he's a student of political history, so he should know.
Did this happen before Bree was born? What year were you born, Bree?
93?
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
93?
This is getting mad.
Even Kate now feels old. Yeah. And that's hard.
Shouldn't you be in school?
Anyway, so... sorry. Let's do it. Bree or not Bree?
Bree or not to Bree?
Bree
or not to Bree? Okay. So... British Airways.
That's definitely before Brie.
That is pre-Brie. So pre-Brie. Pre-Brie. What year do you think?
89?
Brie?
85?
I'm going to say 86.
87.
Oh!
That's when I was born.
Was it?
Yeah.
BBC Magazines.
Ooh, that was probably quite late. I think that was quite late. If you can call this a privatisation, I would say you
can for the purposes of this quiz.
I think it's something like 2002.
Kate,
I'm going to say 99.
I was going to say 95.
2011.
Oh wow! See, yeah. Even later.
Recent, very recent. The stationery office.
Ooh, all right. Stationery office.
The stationery office.
Oh crikey! All right, let's go for a major era. And 95.
Kate.
I'm going to say 92.
91?
96.
Ah, close.
The Severn Bridge. Severn I once Bridge? Wrote a song about Severn Bridge.
Didn't even know it Didn't had I? Been prioritised.
Bring it in next week.
Yeah, okay, 2012.
It was about Richie Edwards. No.
2012.
No.
2004.
Way out, Brie.
Damn it.
1992.
Oh, wow.
And Rolls Royce. Now, there's two answers for Rolls Royce.
Oh, yes. I would say, I think...
Rolls Royce.
I'm going to say 82.
Okay.
There's something in the 60s okay. about Rolls Royce.
Don't want to rush you, but...
Okay, sorry,
1980.
84.
No, it was first nationalised in 1973. and it was again nationalised in 1987. No, privatised.
It it's been a long night, listener.
Yeah, it's been a long week, listener. Anyway, right, thanks for that. That was this week's quiz, so I hope you enjoyed.
Excellent.
That. Anyway, so that was Labour. But very quickly, Paul, you put something very Brexity in the manifesto, very quickly.
Yes, the key thing at this meeting today that's missing from this draft manifesto is any reference to freedom of movement and the EU. And Keir Starmer, only a couple of weeks ago, said that EU freedom of movement rules would end under a Labour government. No reference to that in this draft manifesto. And I think I'm told there will be quite a battle today to talk about that, as well as immigration, to toughen up the language on immigration, which some trade unions want as well. So let's see, after when this podcast comes out, we'll find out whether or not anyone's got their way.
So this week, Theresa May has tried to show a bit more of a human side. And this included a grilling on the BBC One show sofa with her husband, Philip May. Let's have a quick listen.
I mean, how hard is it to win a negotiation with your wife?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, there's give and take in every marriage, isn't there?
Of course.
There? Yeah. I get to decide when I take the bins out. Not if I take the bins out.
But I mean, of course,
boy jobs and girl jobs. You see,
there's boy jobs and girl jobs.
What boy and girl jobs?
I definitely do the taking the bins out. I do the traditional boy jobs by and large.
Yeah,
there we are. Boys' jobs and girls' jobs. I like that. Do I like that? No. Do I find that a little bit dated? Yes, I do. Very quickly, what do we think of her on the one show with Woody Allen? I mean, her husband.
Oh, cheeky.
Yeah, Arthur Askey. Kate, did she come across normal? Was the idea to come across normal?
Yeah, the idea was to come across as, you know, more human. The softer side of Theresa May, shall we say. It was okay. I mean, she shoehorned in a double strong and stable while talking about her childhood, which is pretty impressive.
Make your eyes water.
Philip was good, I thought. He was chatty.
I thought he was
good, wasn't he? I mean, the fact is, a lot of people who know them say that he is 95% of the personality of that couple.
Right.
So, you know, he showed it. You know, he's quite charming. And, you know, it's a very honest as well. I thought that was quite good. He didn't try and sugarcoat anything.
He let slip something, didn't he? Do you remember
about
what he let slip?
Yeah, she'd wanted to be PM when she was in the shadow cabinet.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting.
And that code dates back to 1999. That's quite a long time ago. No, when she first got in the shadow cabinet. But she did go for 2005.
When she first went for the shadow cabinet, then she joined it.
I think
he said
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Or up to 20 years ago. So I think
it kind of fits really.
There was a weird bit where he said that he really fancied her when he first met her.
Yeah.
He said that she was a lovely girl and still is, which was a bit gross.
Grabbed her hand.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird, wasn't it?
Didn't like that.
Prime Minister, mate. Show some respect. What are you doing? But she also received a bit of grilling this week from an actual, genuine, real person. She went to a factory in Leeds and someone there quizzed her over Jeremy Corbyn's £10 minimum wage plans.
You mentioned earlier that you haven't got no plans for childcare, but do you not think it's a big issue that parents are now thinking they're better off not working than rather than going to work because money's that ridiculous? You can pay up to like £40-60 for a day. You're more or less going to work per day to pay for your child. You're not earning nothing, so you're better off being at home. What have you got plans for that? Because the only thing I can think of is with Jeremy Corbyn saying wages off up to £10, that's the only thing that's going to help us out. Other than that, like, every day, no help us. We need money, like, bills will go up and they're not going to make a difference. So it's about now. What's going to help us now? And we need help with childcare, not bills that are going to decrease over 5 years.
Now, Theresa May in the factory this week was quite interesting because a couple of hours before, Michael Crick of Channel 4 News sent this tweet out saying that journalists could only ask questions if they were submitted them first to the Tory aide at press conferences, which wasn't quite true. The process is you have to ask a Tory aide be put on the list to ask a question. You don't have to say what question is you want to ask, right? So I just want to clarify that, dear listeners. But there was this idea, wasn't there, that Theresa May wasn't out meeting real people. And then this week she went to a factory in Leeds and she just said, right, ask me anything. And they did. And it was a real
I thought
range.
It was quite refreshing, actually, because you saw those, you know, great Yorkshire accents asking proper Yorkshire tough, blunt questions. And then that Leeds factory, you know, it wasn't an easy ride and they were quite genuine. And that guy that we just heard, you know, summed up for a lot of people, look, if this is a pocketbook election, Jeremy Corbyn's the only one offering me pounds in my, you know, my back pocket in this minimum wage rise. And that, it went viral online because that tapped into something, not just amongst Labour supporters, but actually, yeah, here's a real voter telling it how it is.
And I thought what was interesting as well was when she was asked questions on things like overseas aid, she didn't give the kind of... She didn't fudge the answer. She was very clear. We give money overseas because it helps us with our soft power. She was very... She didn't try and sugarcoat it. She didn't try and spin it. I thought that was quite, again, quite refreshing to see a politician do that.
I mean, the fox hunting line came out of that as well, didn't it? You know, there didn't seem to be any kind of sugarcoating, as you say. It was quite refreshing to see somebody kind of relaxed and being able to talk about their policies. And I think Jeremy Corbyn adopted like a similar kind of style earlier in the week. And I think journalists were all incredibly sort of grateful for it and talking about how, you know, although it was a bit of a rarity in the campaign, you know, it was actually quite refreshing.
I mean, if you're ahead as much as she is in the polls, for God's sake, when can you... Surely this is the time to relax. And if you can't relax now, crikey. And that's why I think her aides are saying, look, just be yourself, because actually, the more you do it, the better you get at this, let's be honest. And she can be quite stilted socially, but actually this week, I thought in that exchange in Leeds, she looked very much like herself that she is in private.
But is there not the danger, Kate, that you end up, you could leave yourself open to those moments? You saw someone having a go at Tim Farron, for example, in the street a couple of weeks ago. You know, we remember Gordon Brown and Gillian Duffy, and obviously that more came out of what was picked up afterwards. But you could end up having one of those election moments when you meet real people, and surely she wants to avoid that.
She does, and, you know, that's always a risk. But unfortunately, I mean, that is an election campaign, that's politics. You can't, it's not something that you can get away from. And I think if you try and sort of shut her off from that, people aren't stupid. People know that's what you're trying to do. And I think in terms of going back to the journalist thing, like pre-asking questions, yesterday I think they were all told, just put your hands up and take your chances and she'll pick you at random. So they've sort of moved away now from the pre-selecting people to ask questions as well. So I think it's kind of opened it up in every sense.
There has been a worrying tendency in number 10 of late, under Cameron as well, to ask journalists, what are you going to ask? Which is kind of just strange. I mean, I don't ever remember that being under a Labour government, I've got to say, and I've been around quite a while, but there was this tendency under Cameron to sort of gently say, well, what sort of issue are you going to ask? And then they'd push it even further. Well, what sort of bit of that issue are you going to ask? And you'd normally, you'd flannel, and then you'd ask a completely different question. You know, that's the way it works. But so Crick's onto something, but he's certainly not onto some kind of grand conspiracy that journalists are taking part in. And I think it's quite dangerous, given the online atmosphere out there, to somehow make the journalists as if we're complicit in all these party messages.
Exactly. I think that was the problem with the Crick tweet, was it gave an impression of something which wasn't quite there. And a lot of people who were so willing to look for complicity between us and politicians. I say this all the time. We're just trying to get through the day, people. We haven't got the energy to evolve a conspiracy theory. Was that just me?
That is just you.
I'm whinging a lot this week, aren't I? I'm whinging a lot. Sorry, Bree. This is not good for you to hear this. Anyway, but Mr. Ned Simons, who is not here, as our listener will have realised, this week was out and about with his favourite person in the whole world, Mr. Tim Farron. And he spent some time with Tim Farron on at the back of the Lib Dem bus. Not in that way, all right? And here's a clip now of him talking. And listen in particular for the football banter between the two. Ned knows nothing about football. So listen as he tries to flag his way through it.
So I'm here at the back of the Lib Dem battle bus. We're motoring through the Cornish countryside.
We are in Cornwall now, yes.
With Tim Farron, leader of Lib Dems. So you've just got off a hovercraft. How was that?
It was fun. You know, very similar to my own patch. You've got a huge area of sort of tidal sands where people get into trouble very often and need rescuing. And you had a volunteer force of search and rescue people who you know, saved lives and took me out in overalls and a funny orange hat and some sort of slightly weird goggles and clearly make some wonderful photographs for tomorrow that will make me look, you know, moderately ridiculous, but that's part of the object.
It seems in the campaign that sort of you seem to be a magnet for the kind of the more crazy stuff. You know, you had that guy shouting at you. You had do you enjoy those parts?
I definitely do. I think you can't want to lead the people of this country if you don't like the people of this country.
Sure.
And there is a real sense from Theresa May, unless I'm very much misreading it, She just doesn't like people. Right. I mean, wouldn't she spend some time with them? You shouldn't be afraid in politics of someone coming up and saying something rude or disagreeable or just disagreeing with you. Yeah. That's normal life. And if you aren't robust enough to tackle that, how are you going to cope with Juncker?
We're all kind of sort of in the, I guess it's week one of the battle bus, is it? Do you have any sort of battle bus tips? How do you survive? Do you stay
well,
healthy?
First of all, I mean,
keep sane.
We've been for a run last night, so that was great. So staying reasonably healthy is good. Eat some fruit. Other than that, you know, talk to marvellous people like you, and it just makes the hours tick by. And we were in the, just for listeners to get an idea, the back end of the coach here. This apparently was Crystal Palace's coach. So
really?
We are, yes. So we are sat basically in Pardew's boudoir.
So the coach.
I don't think too hard about
it. The coach's gone up in the world, hasn't it?
Do you think so? As a Blackburn Rovers fan, we look loftily two divisions up now in their lower Premier League status. But
Does it have a name, the bus? We should christen it.
We haven't given him one name. No name yet.
We'll think something of
something.
To think about.
I'll put it out to the listeners.
Put out to Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter and the listeners to the podcast to name the
Nothing immediately. We could maybe call him Malcolm after my mate who accosted me in opposition last week.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, so as Ned and Tim, old buddies there, discussing, Tim Farron out on Hovercraft this week, he's very much going for the look. If I'm in a silly picture, at least the picture will get everywhere, kind of campaigning. And that's right. That's kind of what he's got to do, Bree, is that what you think?
Yeah, absolutely. He's had his fair share of kind of awkward encounters on the campaign trail. And I don't think he's shied away from it. You know, he's usually quite engaging in these conversations because he knows that, you know, even if something is a bit, sort of stands out a little bit and might not automatically make him look great, He argues his point. You know, he's going to make the most of these photo opportunities, and you know, he seems to be doing a pretty good job
it's
at that.
Quite
at the
a good debater as well, so he's not afraid of actually arguing and making a case, and he sounds quite eloquent. And you know,
he always does with a smile on his face as well, which I think is quite.
Yeah,
good. I love that.
And you know, the fact that last week he ended up hugging the guy who really hated him, the Brexit voter. That's quite refreshing, really,
well,
to be honest.
Yeah.
Especially given the age we live in, where you know it can be quite dangerous on the campaign trail, as we saw last year.
Speaking of danger on the campaign trail. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
You engaged with some real people against all health and safety regulations.
I did.
And you went on to a focus group in Solihull, I believe, with voters from across Birmingham.
Yeah.
So let's have a little listen to what some of those voters said.
Probably why I can't vote Labour as much as I've voted Labour all my life. I probably won't be able to vote Labour this time. And what frightens me is that there'll be a lot of Labour voters who won't vote Tory because it's against the principles. Well, then we're voting for the Liberals, and that'll be even worse. We've got them as the major opposition, and I think that anybody who's voted Leave and believes in democracy currently must vote Conservative, because otherwise, I think if we might even end up with another referendum and ask the question again, and we're going around in circles.
So, is it now our duty to vote Tory? Is that what I've got to do? I'm going to get thrown out of the country?
Well, he said if you voted Leave... Then, if you believe in democracy, then you have to vote Tory.
That's you then, Paul.
And it was really, really interesting to sort of hear what real people think about Theresa May and about Jeremy Corbyn and about everything. And what was very, very clear was that nobody had any confidence in Corbyn's ability to deliver on Brexit in particular. That particular clip... the group that clip was from all voted Leave, but they described themselves as soft leavers. So most of them said they didn't know which way they were going to go until they were putting their cross in the box. And all of them said Brexit wasn't a key issue in terms of their voting in the general election, but Theresa May as a whole, they had much more confidence in her to stick to what she says, they said. And also, very interestingly, they said that they didn't feel that there's been a no-brainer person to vote for since Tony Blair was leader of the Labour Party.
That must hurt a lot of people.
It was very interesting.
A no-brainer person. That's so true, isn't it? You think about that.
I know. And I love that quote from the guy also in that focus group who said, comparing all the leaders, he said, well, Theresa May is a bit of a dope, but she's less of a dope than Jeremy Corbyn.
He said... He said, I've never, ever voted for someone and gone, they're great, this person's great. I've just voted on the basis of this person's a bit less rubbish than this person, which is really depressing.
But just kind of confirm what we all think, I guess, in many ways. But interesting point about Corbyn there was that, going back to the manifesto, again, we say people might like these policies, But if you can't trust the guy in charge of the party to deliver them, then why are you going to waste your vote in that sense?
Well, exactly. And I think it's sort of stressed. And James Morris, who chaired the focus group, did a really interesting piece afterwards where he basically said there seems to be a kind of Tony Blair-shaped hole in the Labour Party. People are crying out to kind of support Labour and support what they're all about, but they can't get behind.
A pre-wreck Tony Blair-shaped hole. Well, it's worth pointing.
It's funny because I spoke to, interview's going up next week, but a little pre here for you, listener. I spoke to Neil Coyle, who was a Labour MP in Bermondsey, who nominated Corbyn for the leadership and immediately kind of regretted it and has ever since been sort of head in hands. And he said that when he goes out and speaks to people, particularly businesses, he said they are desperate to vote Labour. They want to vote Labour. They need a reason to vote Labour. Which is obviously, I mean, he would say that, wouldn't he, I guess, but it does fit in with what the focus group is saying, that, you know, if there was someone we could vote for, of course we would. We haven't left them for good. This week's, in case you missed it, I'm going to be incredibly selfish and just flag up a story which I put together, which I thought was really important, actually, and it was about the housing crisis. And I spoke to a single mum who has an 8-month-old baby, an 11-year-old son, who fell behind on her rent and is now living in a one-room B&B. Been living there for nearly 6 weeks now, and I discovered through looking through some research that families living in B&Bs for longer than 6 weeks, which is illegal for longer than 6 weeks, has gone up nearly 800% since the Conservatives came into power. So when we think about the housing crisis, certainly I think about it in terms of, you know, getting on the house ladder and that kind of stuff, but actually on a much kind of simpler level, it's people literally homeless who are being housed in temporary accommodation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and there's shocking.
What was really telling about that piece that you did was actually she wasn't unusual. There are a lot of people, particularly mums, you know, with young babies, you know, they're less than a year old, they're months, sometimes in some cases, weeks old, and they're discharged from hospital and they're going to B&B accommodation. And it's quite shocking, really, that it's become an accepted fact that these numbers have increased. And I think if Theresa May really doesn't want to show that she's sort of an interventionist prime minister who can pull the levers of power, then I'm pretty sure that they need to start tackling that.
I mean, the thing is, this woman works. This woman has a job. She works part-time in Sainsbury's. She's off on maternity leave at the moment. And when I put this online, I got a lot of comments from people, oh, you know, why should we be funding this woman's lifestyle? What's happened to the father? All this kind of stuff. Forget that. Forget the mother, if we will. Think about the children. I know it's a cliche, but think about what's going to happen to this 11-year-old boy living in this 8-month-old baby. So it's not, you know, you might want to punish the feckless families if that's how you see them. But actually, the only people you're really, really hurting are the children. I just think it's so bizarre that this has kind of gone on. It's all, I don't feel like it's had enough publicity. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Well, it has now.
It has now, yeah, listener, because you listen to the podcast. Bree, thank you very much for coming in. This is your last one, isn't it?
I'm afraid so, yeah.
You're going, aren't you?
I am, next Friday.
Cool. Oh, you know, we'll miss him. We'll definitely miss him.
He did a really good piece this week. I'd recommend you check it out on integration. So just talk through this quickly about this integration piece in Brighton before you go.
So went down to Brighton a couple of weeks ago and we met with a table tennis charity who work with a bunch of different groups. But the one we were focusing on this week for our Beyond Brexit series for immigration was refugees and EU migrants and also the white working class community in Brighton, so the kind of host community, the people that are taking them in. So we had fantastic interviews with the co-founder of the club and a couple of the refugees and also a couple of the kind of native-born Brits who have received them into it. And it's, yeah, fantastic piece, incredible video. Shout out to Eve Hartley on the video team for doing that. And, yeah, fantastic, really, really inspiring.
And given that we've got the final thing is our election section, that leads us into it nicely, doesn't it?
Election section. Okay, right, yeah, definitely maybe, or what's the story, Corbyn glory?
Well,
it's a bit tricky this week.
Trickier this week than last week, isn't it? I'm going to go Corbyn glory, because at least he's on the pitch this week.
He's
been out and about. He's done some nice photo calls. He's been seen sort of singing, whether it's, you know, Stand By Your Man with the busker. He had his big launch.
Was it Stand By Your Man or Stand By Me?
Hell, Stand By Me.
Stand By Me.
That's true.
That
similar sentiment. Yeah. But he had a big launch, you know, in Manchester. And, you know, he got on the TV, there's no question. There was anger angry jazz, there was calm jazz, there was zen-like jazz. So he's been out and about. People have seen a lot of him this week. And with this manifesto as well, a lot of action on the coverage of it, some of these radical policies. You've got to say at least he's in there pitching.
Let's give it Kate Corbyn-Glory.
Agree. Yeah, definitely.
Green Corbyn-Glory.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Right, where we are, listener. So we're not just all about Theresa May, as someone said. We're about Corbyn as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we will hear from us again next week. Thanks very much.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.